So welcome, welcome everyone. Welcome, it's a delight to see you. So I want to move forward from that guided meditation because I want us to understand and assimilate how what we've been talking about, the birthing of the heart, and particularly for, I think this is the 24th talk. Next talk will be the last talk in this series, and when I come back in May, we'll start a new series. But so this is kind of a rounding out of all the talks. And it necessarily landed on equanimity as the talk that I wanted to do tonight, because it's the most difficult, in my experience, the most difficult for students to understand what equanimity is. Because it holds so much possibilities, potentiality. We see so much of what our life could be within it. But the way we try to arrange ourselves so that we can accommodate it or to make it work within our minds throws us way off. It's not really a supportive component of practice at all because we don't, we try to access it from the wrong direction. You might have remembered that two weeks ago I started the talk by saying that we're on the wrong end of reality. We play this spiritual journey as if we were in control and cultivating the qualities that we need, and I'm not sure where that in order to goes, because if you're cultivating the qualities you need, where are you moving towards? What's the end product of all that cultivation? What do you see as the goal of all that, of that hard work? Because the goal of all that hard work in truth is to step out of yourself, not to step into yourself more fully, but to step away from the false sense of self-perception. And so if we're working this thing according to our own control, according to our own needs, leveraging it as we can, building up what we think is diminished, at what point in that continuum of cultivation do we sense that we have enough? Or that the game has ended? You see, that movement never ceases because the very act of adding more to you doesn't nourish the malcontent, the discontent that keeps us driving for more. It's like somebody who's very rich. I read somewhere, this is true, that no matter how rich you are, you never think you have enough money. Now that's pretty amazing. But it's also true spiritually. No matter how what we assess as the quantity of what we hold, we don't assess it as sufficient for what we perceive as the journey's end. Because when we look at ourselves, we see ourselves still diminished in many aspects. And when we look at the prize, the goal of spiritual attainment, and however we project that goal to be, we often see it as some high and lofty, in high and lofty terms. Really, something that's unassailable, something that's unapproachable. And so to cover that distance, it's much easier to believe that somebody else has it and that we're deprived and that what we have to do is then hang around that other person who has it and somehow there'll be the rub-off effect. Except it doesn't happen. It leaves you in a sense of deprivation. To hang around someone who you think has it and you don't leaves you always feeling deprived. It leaves you with what you came with. It leaves you with a sense of insufficiency. Because we project onto them what we don't have and never can have because we never act like them. thinking that we know how they are behind the scenes, right? And then the revelations occur of what's really happening behind the scenes with some of these teachers. And you thank the good Lord you never got that close to them. See, this doesn't work that way. We're approaching it from the wrong end of the continuum. We think we can muster up enough doing to accumulate the necessities of where the journey takes us. We have to break that way of thinking. We have to stop it. Because that the journey never ends from that. I mean, just see the hopelessness of the situation. The problem is that we really believe ourselves to be hopeless. It's almost, that's an assumption that we start the journey in the beginning and carry right with us throughout the whole time. Is that deeply ingrained sense of inadequacy. And our mind proves it, because we're content one moment and then we're not content. And we have this quality occur and then it leaves us, bereft, journeying for more of the same. And what we do in order to regain our footing back into those states which give us some sense of spiritual orientation, those sense of calm, that sense of calm, that sense of tranquility, that sense of maybe inward space, is that we try to arrange the conditions to be what they were the last time we accessed them. And that could be a retreat, but it can't just be any retreat. It has to be at Cloud Mountain. I didn't get the same room as I... And then you sit for exactly the same length of time trying to surround. Well, I didn't have the same teacher. You see, it was always something a little off. It's always something. You can't imagine the number of people that come to me. And, you know, the last time I was on retreat, and it's not happening this time. And it never will, because we're on the wrong end of reality. As long as we configure ourselves as needing to be complete, we will forever stay incomplete. As long as we believe that the end of the journey is some sense of completion, we will forever be incomplete in that pursuit. It just doesn't work that way. So we have to take a deep swallow, you know? It's like, okay, I have to swallow the hot coal of myself. And what that does is it robs us of the one thing that we feel was the certain way out of ourselves, and that was our efforts. That was our doing. That was all the things that we sense were the right directions to take, and staying away from the wrong directions, and the proper way to be in life, and the moral statement we were making about our behavior, and the goodness we are trying to live up to, and the sense of spiritual, because I wear my mala beads and I bow to the Buddha and I say so many homages, and all of it. All the ritual, all of it. All a form of self-diminishment. Because if spirit is to be discovered, it's to be discovered by what we have, by the additions we have placed upon ourselves. The additives we already have, the coats, the conditions we've already assumed, not in discovering new conditions. So it's not about getting a new layer to put on. It's taking off the endless layers we've already placed on ourselves. It's where what we have defined ourselves to be, those many layers of self-definition that we have somehow continue to encourage all along our spiritual journey. And if we are honest, we'll see that we feel incomplete because we don't have sufficient add-ons that we need, like contentment, like stillness, like patience, like the Brahma Viharas. I'm not loving enough. I don't have enough of that. It's the way from the sense of me, I can only see what my deprivation. I can only see what my deprivation, because the way I'm looking, what I'm looking through, is my discontentedness. So even if, no matter what quantifying amount I have of whatever quality of mind I'm assuming, I still see it in terms of deprivation, because that's how I'm looking. If you wake up depressed, everything around you looks depressed. The sun could be shining, but it's still depressing. Have you noticed that? And most of us carry with us, I mean, the sense of I, the sense of self, carries with it a kind of a spiritual longing, futuristic longing for itself. And that's why it creates a narrative, because the narrative will provide an endpoint where the book is closed on it. Right? But we're well into our narrative now. We're probably 3/4 of the way through a very long narrative. And the book hasn't even begun to close. It's, you know, several thousand pages. When does it close? When does it close? See, we have to feel a kind of nagging frustration that this thing isn't coming to completion. What's the success rate for people who think like that in terms of their spiritual fulfillment? I mean, would we ever look out and look around and say, okay, well, you've been doing this now for 40 years. Where are you? I'm just about there. Well, how about you? I'm getting there. When do we land? See, that takes a complete reorganization. That's the reason we don't land. Is that, you know, we want to land with ourselves. And then we can figure out what the self needs to do in its enlightened state. And how it will shine its sail forward. But you see what I tried to intimate in the guided meditation was that when we're quiet, when we are truly relaxed, when we are not in a spiritual deprivation, a poverty of spirit, when we have released the need to further, to bring context to all the different emotions that we're experiencing and the logic of our thoughts hasn't, when we refuse to find a defining conclusion to all the thoughts, when we've just released our need to identify with them, not waiting until they have satisfactorily ended themselves in some conclusion, or that all the emotions are nicely tied and I no longer grieve, or I have all my forgivenesses together and I've said all my apologies and so that the bow is all, that's not the point. It's just that with sufficient psychic release, you see, you begin to realize that the spirit is nourished with the release not with the addition. And that with the release, we feel something. Something's felt. Something more. Something unmistakable. And it's not quantifiable, because as soon as I try to grab it, it was an apparition. It's like an oasis. I go there and there's no water. As soon as I try to make it my possession, you can't find it. Where was that? And how did I get that? And what did I do in order to get that? And what do I, now you're at the wrong end again of the continuum, trying to quantify the very thing that occurred when we were silent. So this pot stirred again, and we get stirred along with it, and our emotions now feel doubly inadequate because we tasted something that we know is there and we have no access to it, and the frustration grows because we refuse to be quiet. It's too much to ask to be quiet. It doesn't allow me the wherewithal, the management of this thing. It doesn't put me in control. In fact, it disempowers me. It doesn't just make it frustrating. It disempowers me. Because the very thing I'm releasing is what I've always established myself. It's in my reactions. And so when we come to a word like equanimity, we think of it in that way. And it's a word I use very rarely, because it's just, people enslave themselves to that word because it's like a word that all my needs are met within this word of called equanimity. I mean, we think of it as being serenity and unmoving quality and unperturbability, and we think, wow, that's heaven. That's heaven. That's where heaven lies. In fact, it's embellished far beyond its worth. Now, when we were doing the guided meditation, where was the evenness? It wasn't in the mind's rattling. That's never going to be even. You see, at some point, we stop investing worth, spiritual worth, into the mind's activity. We just say, okay, it's going to move for the rest of my life. But where is the evenness? You see, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to allow a deeper settledness to see if there's any evenness there. It's not going to be in the mind. Okay, I now realize that. So I release the need to infuse my energy into the mentally. And that's what I mean by deep psychic relaxation, is that you're no longer looking for yourself through the mirror of your mind. Deeply psychic, deeply physical at the same time. And a space unfolds. A space unfolds, and perhaps you sensed a space unfold within that meditation. And if you looked at the qualities, which is really what I wanted us to do, is to look and see the qualities of that space, you would find that it held all of the Brahma Viharas, all of the things that we most long to nourish in ourselves, were not of ourselves. They're of that space. Evenness. You see, we only think in terms of mental evenness, which is kind of flat line. We don't think of what evenness means in abundance. But when you sense awareness in abundance, and it's applying no pressure, and it's allowing everything to arise and everything to be totally transparent, and it holds everything with softness, with kindness, and when we begin to appreciate those qualities, not because they are mentally strived for, they're not, you can't. As soon as you do that, then we get enveloped in the mind again. As soon as we start leaning away from the abundance that's present, then we get enwrapped, we get embodied in our minds. The way the mind works to become and stay embodied is it reacts. That's what it knows to do. It reacts because it's created an image, and to sustain its image of whatever it might be, its image of contentment, its image of, then it can only do that by changing, manipulating, altering, influencing, leaning, grasping, and that, which is all that reactivity. So if we're looking for equanimity, which is defined by most people as non-reaction, we can't do it mentally, because mentally, all you'll get is reaction and its counterpart. And it'll never be sufficiently relaxed or non-reactive, and will always be on top of it, kind of like a cat at a mouse hole, just making sure that, you know, nothing ruffles up here so that my equanimity can be sustained. See, all of that limitation, quantifiable, all of that, you know, when you start thinking of yourself in terms of that, that you're very bound within the mind frames of reference. When there's release, we are releasing ourselves from that turbulence. And then abundance is. Abundance is, by definition, abundance is. It's not a state of abundance. It's not a quality of abundance. It's what's there when we're not focused upon the limitation of our mind and trying to compensate for that limitation. And that abundance shows us what is. That's what it does. It shows us exactly what is. Just like love caresses what is, equanimity shows us what is. It's just a different perception of the same event. There's not any difference between love and equanimity. It's just that looking from one side of it, it shows us exactly what's is. And we call that, oh, that's equanimity. But if you look at it from the other side of it, it embraces what is, and that's called love. But the embracing of what is and the showing of what is exactly the same thing. Now, when we have what is occurring and an appreciation, which is the natural abundance, when you see things abundantly, So you see, what is connected with abundance? You have mudita. You have plenty of space. You have plenty. The journey is endless. The joy is endless. And so you can share it. You can feel happy for somebody else. It's not me being miserable. When I am miserable and quantifiably miserable compared to you, you can be sure we've taken reference in ourselves. But when there's abundance, and as I was mentioning, that abundance occurs many times during the day when we're not guarded, protected, or in competition, which shows us conclusively that all these states are as close to us as the air around our body. And just by sensing sometimes just that natural warmth of heart that comes, it usually comes with small children or puppies or something that's harmless, because there's no, it doesn't throw us, the animal, the puppy, the child, the infant, doesn't throw us into a competitive mental frame of reference. So we, and as soon as that happens, as soon as the puppy grows to be a dog and it's a, you know, it's, I don't know if it's going to bite me, then that contraction throws us into the mental frame of reference. And it's no longer natural warmth of heart. Or the child grows up to be a competitor in whatever job I have, then we're thrown into the mental frame of reference. But the good-heartedness that was there and is in there for most of us, when we're unguarded, when you're walking in nature, that's one of the reasons that many of us like to walk in nature, is because we're unguarded. The natural walks within nature. And so you can hear the sound of a bird and your heart just lifts. There's just, you see? And that's the pure state. That's the pure state of unequivocal awareness, of abiding awareness. See, it doesn't feel special. That's the thing. We think spirituality is going to transform us into something that's otherworldly. It just takes us out of our normal mental patterns and places us firmly in silence. And in silence, the only thing that can't come into silence, everything can come into silence except one thing, and that's our image, which is made of noise, which is made of our story, which is made of our contention, which is made of comparison, which is made of contrast, which is made of evaluations. You see, that can't enter, because if you try to bring it in, you're noisy, and that confiscates the silence. So the silence can't be heard as silent, because we're in a room alone shouting, yelling. So, that's what we get. We get ourselves and our echo back from the walls. But if we're willing to go in, you see, when we really appreciate, when you long in your heart, then you're willing to give up the image. What have we given up? Let me just, it's an image isn't the fact. It's not what is. It's the idea of what is. That's all it is. So I'm willing to give up the idea and see what the fact is. Now, the idea is just the idea we have of ourselves. Where I was born, who I've been, all the things I have believed about myself with such intent and with such truth. I mean, if just see for a moment, you see, that if you just quiet down, you think the idea quiets with you. No, the idea doesn't quiet with you. The idea, you leave the idea. And once you step out of the idea, you see the abundance. Now, the idea is there if you want to pick it up again, so you can come back and tell somebody. Even though you abide in the abundance, you can still tell somebody where you came from and all of the psychic scars you grew up with. You haven't left the idea, you've left the idea unattended, but it's not forgotten. So you can still pick it up. You just don't have the limitation of it when you move it forward, when you move forward. The limitation of it is carrying it as the truth of what is. But if you're quiet, you can see that it's not true. And spirituality, as I mentioned, is always releasing the faults. That's how we journey deeper into the spiritual, into the sacred, is by releasing everything that isn't necessary to take on the journey. And you get new. Suddenly you realize that you don't want to take anything on the journey, because if you pick up anything, it's artificial. It's unnatural. And so you decide to leave everything behind, because that's what's left after everything, you've abandoned everything that you've gathered all along, your whole life, after you've abandoned everything, that's what's naturally left. And guess what that is? By now you know it, because I said it so many times. It's silent. It's quiet. It's also the four Brahma Viharas. It's love. Isn't it amazing? I mean, it's just amazing. We want it, really. I mean, I think that most of us are sincerely on a journey for it. But the one thing we refuse to give up in order to get what is true and worthy of us is the one thing that's false about us. And we won't let go or release that which is false to understand or to know or to realize what is true, because we think that's such an important part of ourselves, that self-definition. And we have to carry it around us and keep us kind of talking to ourselves about it. That's why this narrative goes all, because we can have a conversation with the narrative to find out what we've done in the past and what we should be doing now. And do I know that it provides me some sense of safety, and behind the knowledge of my image of what I've taken and learned my whole life and all of that? The real fact is that authentic teaching doesn't come from knowledge. How could it? It comes from silence. Let silence do it. And the quieter I become, I see it does a hell of a lot better job. And it's so close. It's not far away. It's so available. And that's equanimity. Not a state of mind. We associate it, I wrote down a whole bunch of words that, detachment, disinterest, disassociation, disengagement. That sounds like a hell of a life to me. Detached, disinterested, disassociated, and disengaged. Why would that ever draw us into that? Why would that ever be an allurement? When I was young, our house was, there were five kids, and I learned how to go way back into myself so that it was like looking through the wrong end of binoculars. So when my mother or a parent would start some long yelling spree, I would just flip the glasses on. And the person would be way across the room, even though they might be right in front of me. Now that's scary because that's a psychic break. That's very close to disassociation. That's very close to cutting myself off and just staying in a cave. And believe me, it was nice in there compared to what it was like 1 foot away. And if my life had been any worse, I could see holding up in there. And why would I ever come out? Cocooned. And you get a sense that the mind can go way back and use itself and counter repose. It has that ability to distance itself and to find some mental state there that feels as if it's unperturbable. But really, it's aversion. Those states of disinterest, of detachment, sound as if they're spiritually alluring. Yeah, man, detach, detach. Detach? What, you backing away, okay? So you back away. So what does that do? How does that bring you life up close? How is that helpful to you? How does that allow you to live more fully? How does that engage, fully engage you? Because we're talking about full embodiment here, you see. And that's the difference, is that life demands full embodiment, not any flicker of movement away. No turning your back on anything, including pleasant. And from that full embodiment of pleasure and pain, we learn. We learn the risks of indulgence in either, or the aversion of one and the indulgence of the other. You learn it because you're hurt when you don't, and you're aware of the hurt, and we're aware of that. So the full embodiment is the full prize, in the sense that it shows us the mistakes of mind travel, of using the mind to satisfy your desires. Shows us right there, if we're willing to look, if we read, know the code of Buddhism, of suffering, of why we suffer. You see it. So this isn't a distancing. This is a full embodiment. The problem is the mind wants to fully embody its image. That's what it wants to fully embody. It wants to convince itself. It first wants to get the image right, and then that's what it wants to be. It wants to be the image. But the spiritual heart, the heart, can only embody what is. Full embodiment to the heart is to fully embody reality. So now we have two conflicting lines. Because if the image, which creates an alternative reality, the imaginary reality, to what is, those two are going to be in conflict. And when they happen to be parallel, which is rare, there's a moment of contentment. But then, they don't line up very often, so that they're in parallel. But we keep trying to adapt and move and train and figure out how to get them in parallel so that we don't have to experience the intersection of those lines, and we can be content. Now that's very different than spiritual contentment. Spiritual contentment releases the need to have an objective an alternative reality, one that is, I mean, a subjective and alternative reality. It releases the need to reconfigure reality in any other terms but the way it's presenting itself. That's all that's required. At that moment in which those two are completely aligned, there is no mind. The mind only comes in and manifests when those two are out of alignment, which is all the time for us. I wish this, I can't say, what's the matter with me? God, if I would just settle down, I'm so restless, what's the matter with me? I'm hungry now. See? When those come into alignment, that's the end of the mind. And there is just this. But boy, do we argue? Do we protest that possibility? Which really means if we can live without an image of how you're supposed to be or how I'm supposed to be or how reality is supposed to manifest and stop, why is this happening to me? Because there's no explanation for that. It is. That's the explanation for it. That's surrender. We surrender our image to what is. But what always gets, this always is so, it's like, it's not as if the image ever wins. It's not as if the image is sometimes successful in changing reality, because reality is unalterable. It can't be changed. It's simply what is. I don't know why it takes us so long to fully understand that fact and release the need to keep protesting that fact. Because it cannot be altered. In the moment it is happening, it cannot be altered. And the simple living with that fact is the full embrace of life. It just seems so, okay, I can do that. Why 20 years? It makes sense to me. I can feel the pain when I don't do that. I don't know. So equanimity is not in movement because reality is not in movement. Reality is simply this. And so when we start trying to adjust the dials, that should be a cue to us. But something's amiss here. There's no dial turning on this. We don't get our way. But we get our hearts. May it be so. Can we sit for a minute or two? Feel the space. the space that does not move. The space that cannot move. Things move through it, but it itself cannot move. Okay, any questions or comments? I will be happy to reply if I can. The identification, what is the mind as I'm using it as a question, and it's the identification with the processes, the mental processes that are, well, it's the ownership of those, right? So it's my mind, and you know, if you look at yours, what's happening up here from the context of me, then the thoughts mean something, the emotions mean something, it all has a context to mean something about you, right? When it's seen from awareness, and if you're in there, in the mind, you've taken the position in the mind, then you can't help but see everything reflecting back some personalization. If you're quiet so that you begin to see how the working of the mind from awareness, which is bigger than the skull encasement, then you can see the mind impersonally. You can see thoughts arising within the space of the awareness or emotions that come without that subjective quality of ownership. Okay, so then the mind breaks down its capacity to hold your image. Once you're seeing it from that spacious point of view, you can no longer see it in terms of a self-reference. Right? Okay. Just to add, well, the quieter you see it, I mean, there are stages of quietude. There's the watcher that's kind of on top of it, who senses the space, but also feels like if they aren't watching the mind, that the mind's going to get out of hand, right? So it's like, you know, I got to keep my eye on this thing. That's not very quiet. There's a lot of discourse going back, dialogue going back and forth between you and the mental occurrences, right? When you see the mind truly in quietude, the thoughts hold no more reference than the song of a bird. No more personalization than just the quiet of the stars. Yes.
First, thanks for your talk. And this may seem obvious, but when you were talking at the end, when you were saying, why is it so difficult? It seems so simple. What occurred to me is that much of the time I'm practicing acting on my feelings. So if I'm hungry, I go get something to eat. Or if I want something to be different, I will speak up. And what you're talking about is very different from that. So I think one of the reasons for me why it's challenging is all this practicing is a different way of approaching the situation.
Yes, very important. So I thank you for that. She was saying that the reason that I was mentioning at the end of the talk that it seems so easy. And at some point, I mean, you can get a sense of how easy it really is. Can't you get just a sense? I mean, if you put aside all the conditioning and all the... I mean, it's really pretty simple stuff we're doing here. There aren't a lot of heads nodding there. Let me assure you that it is. It is. It is really. And at some point, you'll see that. It perhaps doesn't dawn on you yet. But anyway, one of the reasons it seems to be so hard is that we keep finding ourselves persuaded by the logic of our emotions, you know, and our thoughts, because those work in tandem. So that when I'm feeling a certain way, you know, I express that feeling, I act it out. Okay, so that, and I say this often, but I encourage you to actually do it sometimes, is to let yourself sit through a state of mind without acting from it. I mean, that's what meditation really is, that you're just going to sit there, regardless of what the mind configures you to do during that X number of minutes, you're going to sit here. So when you do sit there, just release the feel, sense the expression of mind as an expression of mind, rather than what I would really like to do if I could just get up. All right? Because then you're just being intolerant of having to sit. You're not using sitting for the freeing aspect of just of coming to that space that holds the mind, that knows what it's feeling, that knows what it's thinking, but isn't personalizing it so that it has to act it out from that state or from those emotions. Right? And sometimes we get tugged into the emotions, but other times you can just, it has to do with the depth of your relaxation. Now, why does that work? You got to know all the mechanics. Because as the more we release, what we release are the tensions we have in us that are defending ourselves against whatever display the mind is currently in. So I'm afraid that if I let go of what the mind is doing right now, that my anger will turn to rage, or you know, something awful will show up. And so I have a kind of tension with myself that tries to keep myself in check. Okay, so that's the way I've conceived what's in there, and that's the tension I feel is necessary in order to hold back and suppress whatever I think might come up if I relaxed. Well, you gotta test that. You gotta see it. Okay, relax and see what comes up. Likely, after a while, some things come up. It doesn't mean you have to get up and act them out, though. You just, it's okay, I can feel that. It's okay to feel that. You see, that all the instructions are ever meant to do is to give you the perspective of what's occurring as naturally unfolding without the personalization of what's occurring. So thoughts have a legitimacy, so does an emotion. It just doesn't all have to be packaged together within trauma and defensiveness so that I have to act from it. If I said to you, you know, like, I mean, it's obvious when somebody like the Unabomber, I mean, they've bestowed themselves away and all their thoughts go like this, and they're just, now they act from everything. And you go, wow, that's a crazy person. Hello there. We're all in various degrees of that insanity. So you gotta, I mean, at one time I remember, I said, okay, I like chocolate, right? So I took a piece of chocolate and I put it on the dashboard of my car. It was a really good piece of chocolate. And I was gonna drive and I wasn't gonna eat the chocolate. Just wasn't gonna do it. I was just gonna feel the need to want, and all the desires and, you know, and all of that, you know? And I think I got one block. So it's not always easy. But we've gotta be willing to do it, you know? Start testing the waters a little bit. Don't just Don't just live within yourself with whatever is already there and expect it to change. You've got to challenge some of that. You've got to say, what is this? What's going on here? Why am I so needy about this? What does this addiction feel like? What's the motivation for this thing? What would happen if I didn't do it? You ask the questions are really the gateway, the avenue to wisdom. The questions you ask yourself about the nature of your mind. And you start looking and testing it. You see, you just don't go along with it. Right? Now you say, who is it that's doing it? Don't do that. You're doing it. I don't care. Just get it going, you see? Just get it going so that you're not complacent and just moving with every, you know, and just expecting somehow that you suddenly you will be, you'll be off somewhere and never have to worry about the mind again. No, you know, that willingness to take it on, to look at it, to explore it, to investigate, that is the heart that's in journey and is working towards a fully understanding how the mind and contracts itself around the sense of me. That's how it's discovered, that's how it's known. Others. Have anything else? Yes.
I'm in a period of my life where I'm making a lot of change and I'm noticing that. And then hearing you talk about this, that I haven't been accepting where I am, and so this change is really hard. You can't change if you're not where you're at.
Well,
it's a real struggle, and there's sometimes wanting the desire.
Right.
So
I want to encourage you. She says change is hard, and it's, you know, a lot of change is happening to her right now, and you know, it's difficult to do that. It's difficult to. So let your practice, give your practice one single intent, and that is to be flexible, so that you don't stay anywhere when the next thing is coming. So that there's a mobility. What's the word I'm looking for? Malleability. It's malleable. Is that the word?
Malleable.
Excuse me. Malleable. Malleability. Malleable. So that you're just. Okay. I'm going to sit, and I'm not going to fixate. That's what we all should be doing, because as soon as you fixate, you're located. But if you want to learn, if change is difficult for us, it's because we haven't learned to be malleable, to move with circumstances. And that's what meditation is supposed to be teaching us, so that when we age, we don't, you know, become disgruntled and, you know, et cetera. So bring that into your practice. And start looking for ways in which you're holding to a safe place. You know, and just see how, you see, your heart's going to have to open. Somebody pulls in front of you, there's space for this. Somebody says something to you that's not kind, there's space for that. You're suddenly asked to go someplace you don't want to go, I'll open to that. So you just keep practicing, and I don't mean just when you're sitting, but you're practicing all day long that malleability. Okay, so we have to have some announcements.